Hi, everyone. This is your People Behind the Science podcast host, Dr. Marie McNeely. And I'm excited to have you here with me for episode 836 with our guest, Dr. Heather Lynch. If you want to get connected with us to hear about even more amazing people doing great science, you can follow us on Blue Sky at PBT Science, and I'm at PhD Marie. Now, we have another great conversation on the way from today's guest. So get ready to meet another one of our brilliant people behind the science.
Every day, discoveries are made that will change our understanding of the world around us. Dr. Marie McNeely is here to bring you the brilliant minds who are making these discoveries so they can share their incredible stories and take you on an amazing journey. Welcome to People Behind the Science.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to People Behind the Science. Today, I am thrilled to be speaking with our guest scientist, Dr. Heather Lynch. So, Heather, welcome to the show today. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me today.
Well, Heather, we're looking forward to getting to know more about you and more about the work that you do. But before we get into those details, let me take a moment to tell our listeners a little bit more about where you are today and how you got there. So listeners, Heather is professor in psychological and brain sciences and senior associate provost for faculty affairs at Texas A&M University. She received her undergraduate degree in psychology from Florida State University, her master's degree in experimental psychology and marriage family therapy from California State University, Fresno, and her PhD in social psychology from the University of California, Irvine. And after completing her PhD, Heather joined the faculty at Texas A&M University in 2007. Now, she's received numerous awards and honors for her work, including the American Psychological Association New Investigator Award, the Texas A&M University Faculty Merit Award, and she is also a fellow of the Association for Psychological Science, the Society of Personality and Social Psychology, and the American Psychological Association. And Heather, today we want to get to know you as a scientist, of course, but also as a person. So can you share what do you like to do when you're not busy doing science?
I like to do science all the time. No, I really enjoy new pursuits and new hobbies. So it changes all the time. I like scuba diving. So I go as often as I can under the water. I enjoy painting, reading. A few years ago, I took up trying to build things with power tools.
Ooh.
So I still try to build fences or stairs or whatever it is sometimes. I like long distance running, glass blowing. So just a variety of things that I do like to change all the time.
Oh, that's amazing. So what's your favorite new hobby these days?
My favorite currently is trying to get started glass blowing.
Awesome. How'd you get into glass blowing?
There's a studio in the area near where I live. You can go and observe classes. And I just think the artwork at the end is just gorgeous.
Oh, absolutely. I've seen people do it, but I've never tried it myself. So I think that's remarkable. And I think it's wonderful to have these other pursuits outside of science to have some variety in your life and give you a break when you need to take one from the lab. But let's talk about the work that you do in the lab, Heather. I think you are doing some phenomenal research. So how do you describe it to people who aren't familiar with your particular field or who are perhaps outside of science altogether?
I study emotions. And one of the nice things about studying emotions is everybody has them and can connect with them.
Mm-hmm.
Usually I just say, you know, I study emotions and how they affect people and their thinking and behavior, emotions like anger and boredom.
Very cool. I like it. And I like your point there that it's something that most people can relate to. So you can get people excited about your work easily.
It is. I hear lots of stories.
I was going to say, I'm sure people have some phenomenal anecdotes that they share with you as well. So I think it can help to have these little anecdotes or sayings that you kind of keep in your mind, because while the science that you do is fun and exciting, it's not always easy. So Heather, do you have a favorite quote or a saying or a mantra that really keeps you motivated?
I do. My favorite is the saying, life is a mystery to be lived, not a puzzle to be solved. And I like it because as a scientist, I often come at things trying to solve puzzles and trying to figure out an answer. And life really isn't that way. It really is about exploration and finding new things and new opportunities and new ways of seeing the world.
Oh, cool. Did somebody introduce you to this quote or did you stumble upon it?
I found it in a fortune cookie, actually.
Really? That's awesome. I don't know that I've ever gotten good advice from a fortune cookie, but that's a keeper right there.
But it's from philosophers. So there's multiple philosophers that have a similar saying.
Oh, I love that. Well, let's talk about some of the people who might have motivated or inspired you over your career as well. I know, Heather, as a scientist, you get to work with some really phenomenal people, and there's just these amazing figures that you can look up to as you're going through your career path. So do you have a particular role model or someone who you look up to or someone who really helped you get to where you are today?
I have two. One is more of a thought role model, and one was actually a real life role model. My thought role model was Magda Arnold, who was one of the really early emotion scientists. She was a contemporary with Skinner and some of the big names in psychology, although she's not as well known. And she really had to go through a lot and be very persistent to become a psychologist and a scientist. And she had a lot of ideas that were really revolutionary for her time. So she focused a lot on neuroscience, which was just burgeoning at that point. She studied emotions as the foundation for thought and behavior, which was also a pretty radical idea in the time of Skinner, because he didn't think that emotions were important or should be considered. So she was a radical thinker in a lot of ways. So I see her as a role model. And then also my advisor and colleague, Linda Levine. She was my advisor at University of California, Irvine for my PhD. And she was a real inspiration as a scientist. She was very human. She led a wonderful life with her family and her friends. And she also really valued the integrity of science. And she viewed accuracy and innovation as the most important parts of what we do.
That's so cool. So have you imparted some of this in terms of how you run your lab today?
I try to maintain the same view, yes, that innovation and radical ideas are wonderful, and we should maintain balance and humility and humanity as we are scientists.
That's awesome and tremendously important, I think. And I think every scientist comes into their particular field through a different path. There's not one way to become a scientist or one way to discover your passion for what you study. So can you maybe share some of your story and tell us perhaps from the very beginning, Heather, where it all began for you, this interest in science and emotion?
I guess my interest in science really started when I was an undergraduate and I first started working in a research lab at Florida State University. And they were doing studies on insight tasks, and they were having participants talk out loud as they tried to solve these problems, and the type of problem where people will be trying to work their way through and all of a sudden they have an insight and realize the correct answer. And my job as the research assistant was to sit in the room and record everything they were saying and then transcribe it as they sat trying to solve these puzzles for 20 minutes to an hour. So it was really long, but just sitting and listening to people reflect on their thought processes and trying to work through was just fascinating. And that's when I really got interested in psychology as a science. And then my interest in emotion came much later. I started studying with cognitive psychologists who tend to focus heavily on cognitive processes and thinking processes and much less on the impact of emotions. And as we were working through different cognitive theories, I just felt like something was missing. And eventually I came to the idea that what I felt like was missing was the strength and the power of emotion. Because if you think about how people think, how they make decisions, how they behave, a lot of that is determined by how people feel.
Absolutely. I think we're not necessarily always rational actors, and it can't always kind of be broken down into these logical pieces that come together when you're making a decision.
Yeah, I think almost never is it a rational, like completely rational, emotion-free decision.
So it sounds like you started getting involved in research as an undergrad, you mentioned. How did you really make the decision to jump from this is kind of cool to this is what I want to do for a career?
Well, for me, it was very gradual. So I thought it was kind of cool. And then I didn't really know if I wanted to pursue research or even what you could do with a career in research and psychology. And I was also considering maybe being a counselor of some kind. So when I went to pursue my master's at California State University, Fresno, I did pursue research and I was in an experimental master's program, but I also pursued marriage and family therapy at the same time because I just wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then while I was doing the research for my master's, I fell in love and decided that that was absolutely the career path that I wanted to pursue and applied for a PhD program.
Can you talk about what your experience was like in your PhD program there at UC Irvine?
I love the program at UC Irvine. They really have a very collaborative atmosphere, or at least they definitely did at the time. So they would admit students to the program rather than to work with a single faculty member. So I had the opportunity to work with multiple wonderful scientists and build new collaborations among faculty and among students. They're really fascinating projects that we were able to complete.
Absolutely. And I think as you're nearing the end of your PhD program, there's this big hurdle of figuring out what to do next. So Heather, how did you make that decision?
I don't know if there was ever a point where I was like, I'm going to be a professor at a research university and I'm going to study emotions and make a big impact. I think it was more that I knew I was really passionate about science. I knew I was passionate about working at universities. And so I started applying for those positions and I found a position that was a wonderful fit and where I could really see myself being successful long term.
Very cool. And I think you're one of these rare people where you actually did go directly into the faculty position without doing a postdoc. How did that experience go, that transition into your faculty role? And I guess, do you regret not doing a postdoc?
Well, I know I definitely looked young at the time because when I started, everyone thought that I was a graduate student.
Oh, no.
There was definitely that happening. In terms of the transition, I think it's a tough transition for everyone because all of a sudden you're in charge. And I remember sitting in my office after I started and I had gone to the new faculty orientations and my department head had told me about the department. And then I was sitting alone in my office with my computer. And I remember looking around and going, okay, what do I do now?
Right.
Like, I can do anything I want. I can do any science I want. I have some startup money. I can start projects. What is it that I want to do? And it was a little bit terrifying, a little bit exciting. And I just fell into a rhythm of doing the next interesting thing that I was passionate about. And that led me forward. And I never really regretted not having a postdoc. Once I started going, I felt like it was pretty smooth.
Yeah, I think getting that momentum going is the hard part there right at the beginning. But can you maybe share, you've been at Texas A&M University now, like we mentioned, since 2007. What, I guess, have been some of these key moments in your career that have taken you to where you are today as a full professor and in this leadership role as well?
One key moment for me was when we started doing a major meta-analysis of the effects of emotion on people's thoughts and behaviors and experience. It was a massive project. We looked at thousands of articles and pulled together all of these experimental works that have manipulated happiness, sadness, anger, or anxiety to see if across all these studies, emotions made a difference, right? If they affected people. And at the conclusion of that, we found that emotions do have powerful impacts on people, on the ways that they think, on the way they behave, on their physiology. And we also found that the effects of emotions are all correlated in the way that you would expect them to be if they're being caused by an emotion. And that for me really was pivotal. So for me, it was an important work because it showed that emotions matter very clearly across multiple studies, multiple labs, multiple approaches. And so it gave me a real belief in this type of science going forward. Another pivotal, you mentioned my leadership role. Another pivotal moment was when my department head approached me and asked if I wanted to become the associate department head for a period of time. And it was not anything I had ever considered, but it made me curious about what it might be like to be in a leadership role and about how things worked in the department and the university. So I decided to take that on. And he was a great mentor in leadership. And I think that was a pivotal moment as well.
And I know you've done some remarkable work over the years. We've just sort of skimmed the surface here talking about this one project, and you're continuing to work on some really cool things. Is there one project in particular that you have either completed recently or you have in the works at the moment that you're really excited about and want to share with all of us today?
Absolutely. We have started doing research on boredom as an emotion, and we've published some things on boredom, and then we have a lot more in the works. So it's kind of a large project that I think will be ongoing. And I find boredom just fascinating because even though we experience boredom as people all the time, multiple times a day, as scientists, we don't know a lot about what boredom is or how it affects people. So we're really interested in trying to tease apart what the different effects of boredom are. We're interested in trying to figure out how people respond to boredom in ways that are effective or ineffective and might have consequences for their lives. And then we're also trying to figure out if we can intervene so we can teach people better ways to respond to boredom, which it seems like will have mental and physical benefits for them.
Definitely. And I think this idea of boredom is so fascinating because I think we all know when we're individually experiencing, right? You feel bored and you know that. But what, I guess, is the scientific definition of what constitutes boredom and what maybe doesn't?
So that's a matter of ongoing debate. That's exactly how to define boredom. So in my lab, we come from what's called a functional perspective on emotion, which is that we always are defining emotions by the circumstances that give rise to the emotion. And then the idea is that the emotion allows people to respond effectively to that circumstance. So for boredom, we think in my lab, we argue that the circumstance that gives rise to boredom is the perception that nothing you are currently doing is relevant to your goals. So nothing that's happening is important to you at the moment.
I like that. Well, Heather, this is really cool. And I think you've been able to do some remarkable projects, but not every day in science is easy or fun or full of excitement. I think there is a lot of struggle and hardship and challenge that goes into every successful research project, but not everybody gets to see that side of the story. So we love talking about the struggles, the challenges, the tough times. So do you have an example of a failure in your career or just something you really struggled with? And if so, could you tell us how you got through that tough time?
So I feel like I struggle every day. But there was one particular example that always stands out when I think about a hard time that I've experienced doing my work and my science. It was around the meta-analysis that we did of how emotions impact people, which was a huge undertaking and project. And we had decided initially to review just 10 years of studies, because that was thousands of articles that we needed to review and code and include. And we submitted the manuscript to a well-respected outlet, a journal, and they sent it through the editorial process and it came back with feedback from reviewers that was generally positive. But one of the consequences of the review was that the editor instructed us. So instead of doing 10 years, they wanted us to do all of time from the beginning of scientific studies till the present day.
Oh,
and they
no.
wanted us to do this in 30 days or less. So my graduate students and I, this was all that we did for those 30 days. I had just had my son, who was very young at the time, and I was working 20 hours a day for those 30 days trying to get through all of these articles. It was just a lot. And then at the end, we submitted the revision and it came back as a rejection, which was, you can imagine. But then I went back, and this was an important lesson that I tell my students still, is that I went back to the reviews and I discovered that the reviewer had looked at the wrong version of the manuscript. So they had looked at the previous version before the corrections instead of the updated. So I went back to the editor and they changed their decision.
Oh my goodness. I had to pick my jaw up off the floor for a moment there. I was like, no way. Did that not work out after? So they ultimately accepted it.
They did. Yes. But that moment when I opened the email, and of course it was a late Friday afternoon that it
came. Of course.
It was hard.
So let's tease this apart, Heather. This sounds like an ordeal. How did you keep pushing yourself through this rather than just abandoning this paper or deciding to submit it elsewhere?
So it was hard. And this is why I always tell this story to my graduate students as well, because it took me going back to the reviews and really going through them. And when you receive negative feedback, you know, your first response is always to avoid it, not to think about it. So I really had to work through that and come back to it and go through the review systematically. And if I hadn't done that, I never would have realized that the reviewer looked at the wrong manuscript. For me, it's a good lesson in persistence and being thoughtful and not automatically assuming that you did something wrong, but being willing to fight for work that you know is high quality.
Absolutely. And I guess did extending it from 10 years to all time really change the message of the paper?
No, it was exactly the same.
No.
I mean, the numbers changed a little bit, of course.
Sure.
But the pattern was the same.
Well, that's almost reassuring, though. Now you know that what you saw holds true.
Yes, that's what I tried to tell myself too.
Well, how did you celebrate when you made it through this ordeal?
Well, I know I definitely slept after we finished all the coding. I remember that. Mm-hmm. But I took my graduate students out to celebrate because this was a huge, huge effort and everybody really pulled together to make it happen.
I think that's remarkable. I really appreciate you sharing this story. And I think it is a good example of the all hands on deck moment where everyone comes together to get it done. And it sounds like this had a happy ending, very fortunately. And we love to celebrate the successes in science because I think oftentimes there is a long road to getting to them. So do you have a favorite success story you'd like to share with us, whether it's a big win like this paper or whether it's a smaller but particularly meaningful one?
I guess I have a small win and then several big ones. So my biggest wins are always my students when they successfully graduate and go on to start their careers. For me, that's the biggest success that I experience. And I've been fortunate to experience it multiple times now. Just this past spring, I had 3 PhD students that finished their studies and successfully defended their dissertations. That moment where their committee brings them back and says, congratulations, doctor. It's a wonderful moment because, you know, that's the start of them making contributions and them starting their scientific career. And that to me is the biggest success.
Oh, awesome. And did you want to share one of these smaller but particularly meaningful ones that you mentioned earlier?
I can, yeah. So I get very attached to quotations in my articles when I write. Mm-hmm. It's often how I find my way into the narrative for a project or an article is I'll find a quotation that captures the essence of the idea in the paper. And I just recently resubmitted an article that had a quotation in it. And the reviewers and the editor didn't like the quotation and they made me take it out.
No.
But they overlook the title, which has a reference to the quotation in it. So a small win is that my students and I got in that reference, at least to the quote.
Well, Heather, I love that. And I really support efforts from scientists to make papers more interesting and engaging and kind of more fun to read. So I'm glad to hear that you try to incorporate these things. So it's not just sort of this dry manuscript. And congratulations, of course, to you and your students on all fronts. And we've talked about some of the things that you like to do outside of science earlier. You mentioned that you've got a wide variety of hobbies and reading was among them. We love getting book recommendations from everybody that comes on the show. So Heather, do you have a favorite book or perhaps just one you've read recently that you've enjoyed that you'd like to share with us today to add to our own reading lists?
So I definitely have a favorite author. It's kind of an unusual recommendation, though. So I love books by Stephen King, who, as you know, is a horror writer. What I love about his books is how he develops character and how he develops emotions in the reader so that you end up caring about the characters and you feel fear when they feel fear and you feel sadness when they feel sad. And he's even written a book called Danse Macabre that describes his approach to writing horror. And it really is kind of a psychology of emotions book for fiction writing.
So do you have a favorite Stephen King book?
The Gunslinger probably is my favorite. Although I really like The Green Mile as well.
Both good ones. What did you like about those in particular?
The Gunslinger is a complete fantasy novel. So it creates an alternative world to ours with its own rules and traditions and culture. I love that immersive aspect of the book. And then The Green Mile is unusual for Stephen King because it's not really horror. It really focuses on the majesty of the human spirit in difficult situations.
Absolutely. Well, two excellent recommendations. We will add these specific books. And of course, Stephen King, our listeners may be familiar with, to our website for them to find. And we've talked about some different aspects of your career, but I think one thing about science careers that's really cool are the opportunities that you get to travel. And not everybody knows this as you're entering the career, that you're going to have these conferences, these opportunities to present around the world and meet colleagues all over the world. So do you have a favorite place that your science has taken you, Heather?
Probably my most favorite trip was to the Chinese National Academy of Sciences in Beijing. There was a scientist there that was hosting me during the visit, and their entire lab was so engaged. I was there for several days and they wanted to spend the entire time talking about the work and talking about potential collaborations and the methods that I use. And it also was really interesting because culturally, it was quite different. So the studies I was doing at the time, we would show participants images of chocolate desserts, for example, and it was intended to evoke feelings of desire in them. And my colleagues in China told me that that completely does not apply within a Chinese culture, that the images are actually kind of disgusting within that culture.
That's really interesting. The American desserts did not appeal worldwide.
Not at all.
So did you adapt them? Were there sort of Chinese desserts that you could potentially show them?
I think you definitely could, but it really brought home to me the importance of making sure that your emotion manipulations are culturally appropriate.
Yeah.
If you want someone to feel desire, you have to be presenting them with something that they find desirable.
I think that's an important lesson to learn. So what was the occasion to make this trip to the Chinese National Academy of Science?
So at the time, they had a neuroscientist there that was interested in using some of the methods that I had developed to look at brain responses to effectively laden images. So he really wanted to do a deep dive into the areas of the brain that are activated when you're having different types of emotional responses, things like desire, fear, sadness.
Oh, that's really cool. So then can you share, were you able to do a little bit of sightseeing and explore Beijing a little while you were there?
We did. They were wonderful, gracious hosts. That they took me around to the Forbidden City and we got to explore. We visited multiple restaurants throughout Beijing. I think I tried every type of food that they offer in the city. We had to visit the Great Wall, of course. And they were fantastic hosts and really showed me a lot of the city.
I think that's wonderful. And have you kept in touch with these folks?
Not currently. I did keep in touch for several years after the visit.
Next time they're in the States, they'll have to come visit you in Texas, right?
Yeah.
Well, wonderful to hear about one of these trips. And I think there are so many opportunities in science to go to these places that you may not otherwise think of to travel to for vacation, for example. And I think you get to meet some remarkable people. You mentioned these people you met in Beijing were amazing hosts and kind, warm, wonderful people. And I think that's often who I see in science, but not necessarily the reputation that scientists have in terms of how they're portrayed in the media. I think there's this idea of sort of wild hair, lab coat, and always being very serious and critical. But I think there are some fun traditions, some quirky personalities that you see in science. We love sharing them on our show to try to break some of the stereotypes that people may still have. So, Heather, do you have an example within your lab of a fun tradition that you do or just a story that shows this human side of science?
I think one of the fun things that we do is it falls within training for my research assistants, but we do it at the start of every new semester when we're bringing on new research assistants to the lab. Many of the studies that we do involve creating a situation that evokes emotions in participants. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those are situations that the research assistants themselves help to create in some way. For example, we had a study where participants were supposed to believe that they were rejected. We're answering questions and they had an opportunity to be accepted into a study where they could earn some additional money if they were accepted. And then during the study, everyone was rejected. That was the emotion manipulation for the study. So the research assistants had to deliver that bad news to the participant that they had been rejected. So that's an example of the type of manipulation that we do. So at the start of the semester, when we're training new research assistants, we pair them up. And the person who's pretending to be the participant is the worst participant ever. So they're pulling out their cell phone, they're yelling about things, they're falling asleep during the study. And then the research assistant has to figure out in real time how to respond to this out of control participant. And it's become a kind of a fun bonding experience for the whole lab.
I think that is amazing. And I think these simulations are such a good idea, particularly in your case where it sounds like there's some acting elements involved in trying to ensure that the study is delivered properly.
It really is critical for training for our research assistants to develop the ability to manage participants and deliver the protocol effectively. But it's also a fun opportunity for them to bond.
Definitely. So I have to ask for these simulations, did at least maybe part of one of the simulations ever come to pass? And were people like, wow, I'm glad I was prepared for that?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. So we had a study a few years ago where we were making people angry by having a computer program that would speed up. So they were supposed to be pressing a key as fast as they could when they saw a particular stimulus. And the reaction time that's required would keep speeding up until it was so fast that the people couldn't do it. And we had participants in that study in particular that were cursing at their computers and yelling at their computer screen. It was good that the research assistants were prepared to deal with that type of situation.
Yeah. Well, this sounds amazing. And I think even just the kind of research that you do maybe goes against what people think of in terms of the pipetting and the beakers and things like that, in terms of what scientists are doing every day. You're able to work with people. And I think that in and of itself can create some of these funny and memorable moments.
We've had a lot of interesting experiences with participants.
I can imagine. And I know you're answering some really important questions in science. And I know oftentimes there's limitations, Heather, that unfortunately keep you from answering all of the questions you'd like to answer. But if we took all of those away for a day, if funding, staff, technology, feasibility, all the things that normally hold you back were not an issue, what is the one research question that you would want to answer most?
If I had a blank check to do whatever I wanted, I would really love to know more about the emotion of awe and how it affects people. It's very hard to study awe in the lab. So true awe is experienced when you encounter something that's so far outside of your normal experience and your worldview that it challenges everything that you know. So things like staring into the face of your newborn child, or seeing the Earth from space, which can radically shift your view of what it means to be human and of the world. And I think it's hard to simulate that in a lab effectively. So if I could do anything I wanted, I would develop an experiment with awe and measure how it transforms people.
Ooh, I like it. What in particular, I guess, would you want to know about awe? Or do you have hypotheses about what you think is happening?
The theory is that awe as an emotion allows us to accommodate new information. And because of that, it can lead to a radical shift in your worldview and how you view yourself as well. So I would love to be able to test that hypothesis of how and how much awe shifts or transforms our views of the world and ourselves. So you can think about someone staring into the face of their newborn child. Part of the awe is that there's this new life that's been created. But part of the shift is you are now responsible for that new life.
Right.
And I think that feeling of awe is part of making that transformation from non-parent to parent. But we don't really know a lot about how it's helping us make that transformation.
Definitely. And you mentioned earlier that you have children. How was this experience for you, that first moment of awe looking at your newborn child?
It's incredible, right? That suddenly there's a life in the world that wasn't there before. And it is overwhelming. I remember we were walking out with our new baby and it felt like someone should stop us or train us.
There should be a license involved. Yeah.
Somebody should check that this is going to be okay.
I think that's amazing. And I think I'm sure so many of our listeners can relate to that moment of, are you sure I'm allowed to do this? Because I think there are a lot of those in life.
Yeah, it's such a big responsibility, right? You feel like you're never completely prepared to take that on.
Oh, absolutely. Well, wonderful to hear about this dream research project that you would do, given all of the possible resources. And we appreciate you sharing insights with us on the show, but we'd love to talk about advice as well. So for our listeners out there who are perhaps struggling along their own journeys, Heather, do you have one piece of advice that somebody gave you at some point that really helped you that you can share with our listeners?
I do. I have two, but they're related. So I hope you'll let me share both.
Of course.
So this wasn't given to me explicitly as advice, but it's advice that I learned from interacting with, at this point, literally thousands of scientists and faculty members as part of my job in faculty affairs. And I have a great opportunity to meet some of the top scientists in the world in that role. And the things that I've learned from them are to make sure that you keep focused on the big questions and the big important things that you want to know in your science, because it's so easy to get caught up in the day-to-day and some of the trivial tasks that we all have to do. And it's easy to lose sight of those big important questions that you really want to know the answer to. And then as part of that, what I learned from them is to make sure that you are working with and talking to people who keep you focused on those big questions. So I've learned that keeping focused on the big questions and keeping people in your life that help you focus on the big questions are critical.
I think that's really good advice. And I think you're absolutely right. It's so easy to sort of drown in your daily to-do list of basic tasks that just have to get done by somebody at some point during this 24-hour period, that you do lose that big picture reason of why are we doing this and what are we working towards?
Yes. And we can spend your entire day working on email or IRB applications or things that need to get done, but they're not actually critical to the questions you want to know the answers to.
Definitely. Well, wonderful advice for our listeners out there. And Heather, is there any other last piece of advice you'd like to share or a last note of inspiration that you'd like to leave everybody with at the end of our conversation today?
I think my one inspiration is to keep asking great questions. I think that's the key to great science and innovation, is to really develop these great questions that once we find the answers, it changes how we think about the world.
Oh, I love that. And how do you identify or how do you judge whether you have a great question or it's just sort of an all right question?
So one way that I judge if it's a great question is if I still find it interesting the next day.
That's a good test.
Sometimes I'll come up with something like, oh, well, that would be kind of interesting. And then the next day, half the time, I don't even remember the question. And other times I find myself still thinking about it the next day and thinking about new ways that it connects to other questions or other pieces of evidence or signs that I've heard other people talking about. And those are usually the questions where there's enough drive behind it that these are going to be important questions to ask.
I love that advice. And I know for you specifically, we focused a lot on your research, but you're also balancing this leadership role, as we alluded to. Do you have any advice for people out there who are maybe going through the same thing or interested in pursuing kind of this dual path of being a researcher, but also having some kind of administrative and leadership roles within academia?
So for me, it was another way to make a difference. Often in science, the work that we do, at least the work that I do, it has applications and it has use and it can lead to products and innovations and interventions that help people. But a lot of that takes decades. And a lot of that work I don't do myself. It's people that are using the work and developing those applications. And one of the great things about leadership is that I can see the impact immediately and really make a difference within the lives of the people around me. So that to me is very fulfilling.
Absolutely. I think the immediate gratification is something you do not get a lot of in science. So
yes.
Well, wonderful note to end on, Heather. We really appreciate you speaking with us today. If our listeners want to learn more about you and the work that you do, what is the best way for them to do so?
I have a website at emotionsciencelab.com where we post about a lot of the work that we're currently doing. And I've also been writing for Psychology Today. I write a blog about once a month that's all about emotions and how to use emotions in your daily life.
Excellent. Well, listeners, definitely check out these websites. And Heather, thank you again so much for your time today. It's been such a delight to learn more about you and your work.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me.
It's been great to have you, listeners. Always wonderful to have you here with us as well. We hope you'll join us again for another episode of People Behind the Science.